Welcome back to Time for an Awakening. And we're joined this evening by a special guest. You know, this is kind of like part two of our discussion on the civil rights era of our history here in this country. Last week we had We Will Shoot Back's author, Professor Ankiele Umoja, was with us. And this week we have a distinguished guest, journalist, visiting professor of African studies at Brown University and former field secretary with SNCC from 1962 to 1967, and currently the senior analyst at allafrica.com, Professor Charles Cobb Jr. is with us to discuss the book, This Nonviolent Stuff Will Get You Killed, How Guns Made the Civil Rights Movement Possible. Welcome to our program, Professor Charles E. Cobb, Jr. Professor Cobb, are you with us?
Yes, I'm with you. Hello.
How are you, sir?
I'm fine. Hello. Thank you for inviting me.
Oh, it's no problem. You're with us this evening on Time for an Awakening, and we're glad to have you. You're joined by myself, Elliot Booker, and Brother Ralph, and Brother Reg.
All right. Okay. Again, well, I'm open to whatever you need from me.
Professor Cobb, we want to talk with you about the book, and your life is very interesting, so I might veer from the book on several occasions to talk about your life, period, because you're a very interesting man. You have done a lot of things that have made an impact on our people in this country and on the mother continent. So we want to kind of, I want to span the gamut and talk about a lot of different things in your life. But tonight, sure, we want to focus in on the book, This Nonviolent Stuff Will Get You Killed. Mm-hmm. And one of the reasons that we want to do this, and I was, I guess I'm just like a lot of our other people, I didn't realize the impact of a lot of other people involved in this movement till I read We Will Shoot Back. And I didn't get a chance to get your book yet. It's on order. But our co-hosts have the book. Mm-hmm. And I want to talk about some of the people in the book because I know that a lot of our listening audience knows nothing about them. But before we get started this evening, I want to ask you a question about, as a young man at Howard University in 1961, 62, what made you get started and involved in the civil rights movement? And let me preface that question with this, because I heard you make this comment on a YouTube clip when you were talking about your book. You stated that your friend Julian Bond gave a narrative of the civil rights movement, and it was a couple of things that bothered you. You said that Selma didn't just happen in a vacuum, and also, let me throw this out there, because I want you to kind of tackle it all. You mentioned that the civil rights movement, according to Julian Bond, was reduced to Rosa sat down, Martin stood up, and white folks saved the day. So
yeah,
go ahead.
The exact quote from Julian, and this is right when I was just beginning this book project, and I was telling Julian what I intended to do, because part of what I intended to do with the book and tried to do it with the book is challenge this narrative that exists about what took place in the South in the 1960s. And Julian kind of quipped. He said, yeah, the way the public understands what happened is Rosa sat down, Martin stood up, and then the white folks saw the light and saved the day. And he was really making a joke here. And it's true. That's what the narrative really boils down to.
Okay.
You know, people don't see what really happened. That's the confusion over guns, the confusion over nonviolence, the confusion over sit-ins, and so forth, because people can't see, because it's not taught, what really happened.
Well,
the movement was more, much, much more than mass protests in public spaces led by charismatic leaders like Martin Luther King. Most of the Southern movement took place in the rural communities of the South, and it was led by Southerners, not by guys like me who came from Howard University or wherever, from above the Mason and Dixon line, but really by settlers who decided to take control of their own lives. And that story is barely told.
Well, and that kind of leads into that first question that I'd ask. What made you as a young man at Howard get involved in the movement?
The sit-ins.
Yes.
Ask anybody from SNCC, of course, they'll tell you the same thing. As a friend of mine says, the sit-ins woke me up. I'm looking at, you know, before the sit-in movement that erupted on February the 1, 1960, when the Greensboro students, four of them, sat in, and then spread across, you know, all the black college campuses, which are largely in the South, a civil rights struggle, or freedom struggle, if you will, a term I prefer, was largely led by grown-ups. What happens with the sit-in movement is that for the first time you see young people moving into leadership roles. So I'm looking at people my own age doing things that I admire, and I want to be a part of that. And I did become a part of that as a Howard University student. So it was the sit-ins. And the sit-in led me deeper in the South because I wound up, CORE, in fact, invited me to a workshop in Texas, and I took a bus through the South. I got off the bus in Jackson, Mississippi. And the reason I got off the bus in Jackson, Mississippi, was because the students in Jackson were sitting in. And my attitude about Mississippi, and I think the attitude of my whole generation about black people my age, about Mississippi then was, A, it was a place where Emmett Till was murdered, and B, it was possibly the worst place in the universe for a black person. So it was hard for me to get my mind around the idea that black students in Mississippi were sitting in. I said it was one thing for me as a Howard University student to be sitting in Virginia and Maryland. It's a qualitatively different thing for the students in Mississippi, the place where Emmett Till was murdered, to be sitting. So I wanted to meet them.
You know,
I made my way to their headquarters, and I told them pretty much what I'm telling you. I just stopped off to introduce myself. I'm on the way to Texas for this workshop on civil rights for young people. And then one of these students I'm talking to, Lawrence Guyot, who just passed away a year or two ago, who would become the chair of the Mississippi Freedom Democratic Party, but then he was a Tougaloo student. And he got up from his seat, and he hovered over. Guyot was a big guy. And he said, I never will forget the words, he said, you're going to Texas for a workshop on civil rights? What's the point of doing that when you're standing right here in Mississippi? And then another student, Jesse Harris, who just died 2 months ago, looked at me and he said, yeah, Charlie, you're in the war zone here. So I got the message. They said, well, you can go off somewhere and chatter about civil rights if you want to, but we're getting ready to do stuff here. If you want to do something as opposed to just talk about something, then stay with us. And that's what I did. I wound up staying, though, for almost 5 years.
Okay.
In Mississippi.
You know.
So that's what it is. And that's an important lesson in there that people don't get about the movement, is that as much as that movement, the movement challenged white supremacy and white power, just as important, maybe more important, is the fact that if you really want to understand the movement, you also have to understand the challenges that black people made to one another within the black community, because that's what the students were doing. They were challenging me. You can talk, or you can do something. And it led me to do something in Mississippi.
You know, and that you kind of led right into the second question I was going to ask you. Why did you choose to go to Mississippi? You know, according to published reports and information, Mississippi was the worst state as far as lynchings and unsolved murders of our folks than any of the southern states. So I just thought it was the courage that you had as a young man to go to the belly of the beast, so to speak, was...
But I wasn't planning to go to Mississippi. I was just passing through.
Exactly. I'm just...
And I stopped. I just meant to introduce myself to these students, because I wanted to meet them, because precisely for what you just said, if they're sitting in that state, maybe they got some special gene that I need to know something about.
Okay.
I wanted to meet them. And then they challenged me to stay in Mississippi. It wasn't in my plan. When I got on the bus in Washington, D.C., I did not plan to get off the bus and stay for 5 years in Mississippi. it was those students. I whenever I'm in Mississippi, because I still get to Mississippi several times a year, I say, you guys kidnapped me, you know. And so that's how that happened. And that's the way a lot of stuff happened in the movement. Martin Luther King emerged as a leader because E.D. Nixon, the head of the Brotherhood of Sleeping Car Porters in Montgomery during the bus boycott, accused the ministers of being cowards.
Okay.
And Martin Luther King stood up and said, I'm not a coward. And he was 26 years old. And they formed the Montgomery Improvement Association after that and made Martin Luther King the head of it. So you see these kind of challenges all over the South, but that story is not well told either.
Professor Cobb, you know, as a young man involved in SNCC and in Mississippi, what was the strategy about organizing in these small areas, rural areas of Mississippi? It would seem as though, I mean, it's fascinating speaking to a man like yourself, but what was the strategy? What was the plan? How did you plan to organize in these small communities?
Well, there had been, you know, the whole tradition of black struggles in the United States going all the way back to the beginning days of the country is an organizing tradition. You know, if you think about it, enslaved Africans were not having sit-ins at the plantation manor dining room table seeking a seat at the table. And they weren't holding protest marches on the auction blocks. Well, what were these enslaved Africans doing? Well, they were organizing something. They were organizing a way to escape. They were organizing sabotage and work slowdowns. They were organizing rebellions. They were organizing assassinations. So this organizing tradition, if you look at black history, goes way back before us in 1960s in Mississippi. And so there is a foundation on which we stood. An important part of that foundation were men and women who had been out there before some of us had even been born. And they took us under their arms, into their arms. They told us two things. They said, this is what we want. What they wanted was some black power. And the way they saw getting that black power was getting black people registered to vote, because it wasn't on our mind until these older people, most of them the ages of our parents and grandparents, put it before us. They said, we need black power, and we got the numbers to get it and to get rid of these sheriffs and mayors and boards of supervisors if we can get our people to register to vote. And they liked us because they saw us as having energy, I think.
Okay.
And they said, that's what we want. And then this is how you get it, you know. So what we did, to use in the current language, we embedded ourselves in these communities, and a lot of it was a first thing you had to show was that you couldn't be run out with guns. Because I wasn't the first town I worked in, Woolville, Mississippi, a little town of 1,100 people up in the Delta. I mean, we weren't there. We had been there one day. The next day, the mayor pulled up in front of us, jumped in the car with a pistol, and told us to get out of town.
Oh, wow. Okay.
So you had to show people you couldn't be run out of town. And then people were scared, legitimately so, because you could lose your job if you tried to register to vote, or you could get shot or killed. And we being sick people, all have stories of murder and violence and all of that kind of stuff. So what you had to do was kind of earn, what I call earn the right to organize, because that meant sitting on front porches, talking to people, going to church with them, eating dinner with them, going to the juke joint with them. There are lots of ways you have, and because what people know, they have to judge you. Here you are in town, even if you've been introduced by somebody, as we were, by one of the community leaders, they have to make up their minds about who you are and whether or not they can invest some trust in you. And that doesn't happen quickly, because they know one thing they know with absolute certainty is that you can do the one thing that they can't do, and that's leave town when the going gets tough.
Okay.
That's what they know. So you have to build a relationship. That's how you organize people. You talk to people, and you know, you stand up for people. you walk into the courthouse with them and say, this is Ms. So-and-so and Mr. So-and-so, and I brought him here to register to vote. That's how you do that. And that's what our, you know, what we intended to do when we began the work in Mississippi and Southwest Georgia and Central Alabama and the Arkansas Delta, or if we're talking about core in Louisiana and South Carolina, was get enough people registered to vote to get rid of these white supremacist systems, or make bring enough attention to the fact that black people were denied the right to vote, to force the federal government to take some actions. You had to. We wanted to help people find their own voices, so they could stand up and demand the kind of society that they wanted. That's what, you know, we didn't come down there with a master plan.
Okay.
Because people, if you're saying that we thought that people had a right to make the decisions that affected their lives. So what they were, you had to encourage people to begin to actually do that. You didn't have to make, people knew what they wanted, in fact, but they never raised their voices to get it for the most part. So we were there to help people do that. They had to make the decisions. I wasn't going to live in Mississippi for the rest of my life, so I wasn't going to tell people how to live in Mississippi. I was an organizer, not a community leader, and there's a real difference between the two.
You know, you mentioned in the beginning of your statement that you just made about the first threat that you received, and it was only a day after you were there.
Yeah.
And that kind of ties in with your book. Talk about some of the people that helped you. I see in a clip that you mentioned the Green family, and also you mentioned the McGee's.
Greenwood, yeah. Well, see the title of the book, This Nonviolent Stuff Will Get You Killed. That's a quote. It's an abridged quote from a black farmer.
Okay.
In Mississippi. His name is Hartman Turnbull. I talk about him in the book. Mr. Turnbull is a legendary figure to people who know the Mississippi movement. And he wasn't nonviolent. He wasn't nonviolent. And he drove night riders away with his Winchester one night. And when we showed up the next day, the first thing Mr. Turnbull said was, I wasn't being nonviolent. I was just protecting my family. People saw themselves as being in this, quote, nonviolent movement and would tell you they were a part of it while they were cleaning their rifles. Now, when Mr. Turnbull met Martin Luther King in 1964, after the formalities and courtesies of introduction, he told Martin King, he said, Reverend King, this nonviolent stuff ain't no good. It'll get you killed. Now, that was just too long for the title, so I shortened it to This Nonviolent Stuff Will Get You Killed. But there are a lot of people like people. The movement unfolded in the rural South where guns are just a part of the culture. If you were living with families or, you know, often on small farms and the like, they felt obligated to protect you. The way you protect somebody from the Ku Klux Klan is to drive them away with a rifle. And that's what the book talks about. And this is an old story in black life. I mean, again, it's not a 1960s story. It's not the story of young black militants coming down with weapons and showing people how they had to engage in armed resistance. No, this is part of the culture of the South. People who had guns. I never stayed with a family who didn't have guns, and they use them for hunting, they use them to keep varmints out of the garden, and they use them to drive away the Ku Klux Klan when necessary. And people made very practical choices about when it was viable to use a gun and when not, because generally you don't see many you don't see really shootouts with police, for instance.
Okay.
You see them, as you saw them in North Carolina, say, take Robert Williams. There were several shootouts between his NAC branch, not with the police, but with the Ku Klux Klan.
Mm-hmm.
And same thing's true in Mississippi and Alabama and Georgia. People, I see, as you know, the subtitle of the book is How Guns Made the Civil Rights Movement Possible. That's because if you're dead, you can't do anything. You know, You just wouldn't have had a movement if the people trying to cultivate the movement were being killed.
Okay.
And that's what white people were trying to do until they learned that the people they were coming after were increasingly inclined to shoot back.
You know,
as you talk to Akinyele, I mean, you have to know this. I mean, his book, We Will Shoot Back,
yes,
tells that story in Mississippi.
Yes, very much so. We're joined in conversation tonight with journalist, visiting professor of African studies at Brown University, and former field secretary with SNCC from 1962 to 1967, Professor Charles E. Cobb Jr. The book, This Nonviolent Stuff Will Get You Killed, How Guns Made the Civil Rights Movement Possible. You can get involved in this conversation by dialing 215-253-7263. That's 215-253-7263. Professor Cobb, before I turn the mic over to my co-host, Brother Reg and Brother Ralph, you talked about one of the men that I was going to get you to talk about, Mr. Hartman Turnbow. Mm-hmm. Talk about three others that I have that I want you to give a analysis of and talk about. And you probably had some contact on dealing with him. I know you did. Mr. Amzie Moore. Talk about him.
Oh, yeah. Okay, Amzie Moore. And Amzie Moore represents several things, but one important component in the movement has to do with World War II veterans.
Okay.
And, you know, they've been out there fighting Nazis and Japanese fascists and Italian fascists. They came back home at the end of World War II and were not inclined to accept white supremacy. And they really, if I had to identify a single group of grown-ups who were critical to us as young people, I was 19 years old when I went to Mississippi, it would be the World War II veterans. You know, and they not only provided armed self-defense for us, but they had organized organizations that ranged from NAACP chapters to something like the Progressive Voters League up in the Delta of Mississippi. This is at the end of World War II. And Amzie was the one who actually put SNCC, I mean, it put voting, struggle for voting on SNCC's table in 1960. Bob Moses, who had become a project director for SNCC in Mississippi, was traveling through the South recruiting students to attend SNCC's second conference. And Ella Baker, great lady of 20th century social change, had given him a list of names, one of whom was Amzie Moore. And when Bob got to Amzie's house in Mississippi, which is up in the Delta of the Cotton Country, Amzie made it clear he was not interested in having sit-ins in his little bitty town. What he wanted was voting and a struggle for voting. And he had a plan about which counties you needed to work in, which were the most dangerous ones, and all of that. And that's how the idea of voting made its way into SNCC. And then Amzie's home became, for the next half dozen years, SNCC's command center in the Delta.
Okay.
It had a telephone, he had a car, he had a network that ranged from NAACP people to Prince Hall Masons, which meant that we could move from place to place, and there was always somebody who was prepared to feed us,
okay,
to take care of us. See, this is like an underground organization.
Okay.
And maybe because it was like an underground organization, people don't understand it. They don't see it. The movement was entirely composed of nonviolent protest marches. No, it was guys like Amzie, who were tough and smart and committed, that made the movement, not just in Mississippi, as I said, but everywhere in the South. So that's the short version of Amzie's story. I could go on and on about Amzie.
The next gentleman that I want you to discuss a little bit about is Eldridge Willie Steptoe.
E.W. Steptoe, E.W. Adonis. No, he lived not in the Delta. He lived in southwest Mississippi, which was probably the most Klan-ridden, Ku Klux Klan-ridden part of the South. And again, he's like Amzie, tough, strong, committed, and he liked the SNCC people because, and I think they liked us just because we were young and energetic. And they had their own ideas about how they wanted to use us. When Bob Moses, who was brought by another NAACP leader to meet E.W. Steptoe, after introductions, the first thing Mr. Steptoe said was, "I've been waiting for you." Steptoe formed an NAACP branch in Amite County. That's where the county he lived in 1952. Just because he heard about, he was a dairy farmer, and he had brought his cows to sell in New Orleans and heard about the NAACP and said, "Oh, that sounds like a good idea," and organized one up in Amite County, a county where the head of the Ku Klux Klan was the son of the sheriff. The next year, he built it, almost had about 200 members in that county. And then during one meeting, and he had a little church on his farm, the sheriff and a whole posse of white men came in and seized the membership list. Well, you might imagine that the membership in the NAACP dropped sharply after that. And what Mr. Steptoe did was buy, personally, enough memberships to sustain an official, legitimate branch of the NAACP in his county. He had that kind of determination.
Okay.
I remember when a sick worker came to live with him, there was a woman, the first thing he did was take her out to the pasture and teach her how to use a .45 pistol. And whenever she took his truck to go somewhere, he always insisted that .45 be in the truck. I mean, these are the kind of people we were dealing with in the state.
C.O. Chin.
C.O. Chin is a legendary figure. He really was working on a poor project in central Mississippi, Madison County, Kent, Mississippi, another violent, violent place. When the Knight Riders attacked his house, he not only drove them away with his rifle, then he got in his truck and chased them and shot up the Ku Klux Klan gas station where they had fled to. Again, C.O. Chin was, he had a small farm. He ran a rhythm and blues nightclub. He was a bootlegger, had other activities that skirted the boundaries of legality, but he loved the poor people.
Okay.
And he was going to, and he ordered all his family to protect his children and net to protect the poor people. The famous story about, and I tell it in the book, C.O. Chin is, there's a poor worker has been, is on trial for, some kind of traffic violation. And C.O. Chin, now C.O. Chin wore a pistol in a holster. He was the first black man I ever saw wearing a pistol in a holster outside like a cowboy. And he walked in during this trial and he's wearing his pistol. The judge says, "Now, C.O., you know you can't come in here with that pistol." And the sheriff is there, Billy Noble. And everybody knew that there was bad blood between Sheriff Billy Noble and C.O. Chin. And C.O. looks over at Billy Noble and tells the judge, "Well, as long as that SOB over there is wearing his pistol, I'm going to keep mine."
Oh, man. I'm sorry.
the judge says, and of course you think there's going to be a shootout now, but then the judge intervenes. He says, "Now, boys, let's be good boys. Why don't you take your pistols out and put them on the table in front of the bench?" And C.O. slowly eases out his pistol, and Sheriff Billy Noble slowly eases out his pistol, and they lay it on the table in front of the judge. I mean, C.O. was a tall, lanky guy, and again, tough and committed. These are not, you know, ideological people. These are people who made up their mind that what these movement people are trying to do is a good thing, and we're going to keep them alive.
Okay.
That's why the Deacons for Defense organized in Louisiana, and a number of other groups organized.
Two other people I want to ask you about before I pass the mic. One person I know you had direct contact with. The other one, I'm not sure. Miss Ella Baker.
Oh, no. All of us at SNCC consider ourselves the political children of Ella Baker. It just would not have been a SNCC without Ella Baker.
Okay.
When the sit-ins happened, she was then Martin King's executive secretary, the Southern Christian Leadership Conference, and she had helped organize that group. In fact, she was actually the temporary executive director because these preachers had a lot of trouble with women in executive positions. But when the sit-ins happened, she immediately recognized that this was something important, and she got $800 from Martin King to bring student leaders together at her alma mater, Shaw College then, Shaw University now. And out of this meeting came SNCC. King gave the money because he really was looking for a student wing to his organization. And Miss Baker knew that. And she was Miss Baker to us because she was 57 years old when she did this. And she immediately went around and said, you don't need to be a part of some grown-ups organization. Have a conversation about forming your own organization.
Okay.
And out of this came, she had been the NACP's director of branches in the 1940s. So she had a whole network across the South that was invaluable to SNCC. And she was the one who told us constantly, you organize from the bottom up. You keep your ear to the ground. You listen to what the sounds at the grassroots. If you really want to organize, which is, she's extremely influential with us in SNCC.
Okay. Miss Fannie Lou Hamer.
And again, Mrs. Hamer. I was with Mrs. Hamer the first time she tried to register to vote.
You said you went with her?
Yeah.
Go ahead.
And so that Sunflower County is the first place I ever worked. And now, Mrs. Hamer, again, you see these older people. Mrs. Hamer was what? When she tried to register to vote in 1962, she was 47 years old. Now, and she emerges as an important leader. What had happened was people went down to register to vote. Mrs. Hamer and 17 other people went down to try and register to vote at the courthouse. And after a couple went in to try, the circuit clerk shut the office down. And, of course, there's these police and posse people are all swirling around with their pistol. And we had gone down on an old raggedy bus that was usually used to haul day workers to the cotton fields. And we got back in the bus, getting ready to go. And by the time, when the bus reached the edge of town, it gets stopped. And the deputy sheriff arrests the bus driver for driving a bus of the wrong color because it was an old school bus. So he says, you're under arrest because it's illegal to drive a bus like this. So now the question of what to do. Anybody then who tries to drive the bus presumably would get arrested. It's getting near dusk.
Mm-hmm.
The last thing you want to be is on the road, known as civil rights people, as the sun is setting, then you're vulnerable to all kinds of things.
Okay.
The question is what to do. And then from the back of the bus, this voice starts singing. And it's Mrs. Hamer, these songs, these freedom songs. They ain't going to let nobody turn me around. This little light of mine, keep your eyes on the prowl. And just through the power of her voice alone, she shored up the bus. Because remember, we SNCC organizers didn't have anything to offer people. We couldn't say, yeah, we'll keep you alive. She emerges as a leader in first in Sunflower County in that fashion. It goes on to become one of SNCC field secretary. She was SNCC's oldest field secretary at 47. And she goes on to become a powerful Southern voice for civil rights, partly because of her role in the Mississippi Freedom Democratic Party and her testimony at the Credentials Committee of the Mississippi Freedom Democratic Party. She died too young. She was badly beaten.
Okay.
The Winona jail in 1963. Badly beaten. along with others. She never really quite recovered from that.
Okay.
And as far as I was concerned, even though it took a long time, she was killed in that jail.
Okay. Let's go to the phones, and then I'm going to pass the mic to Brother Reg and Brother Ralph. 704 air code, what's your name? Where are you calling from?
Hey, this is Brother Scotty calling down, calling from North Carolina. Greetings to everyone.
Boy, he's got
Dr. Cobb, thank you for your contribution to the freedom struggle that is ongoing. But I want to thank you, and most importantly, for documenting this history, because as you have pointed out that, you know, there are people in this country who only want us to have one narrative. And, you know, it's just one dimension of our struggle for freedom.
Right.
And, you know, that's just very incorrect, as you noted, from the first enslaved Africans, you know, struggling in different ways to obtain mm-hmm. their freedom. But I want to bring it back to Robert F. Williams, you know, because I live mm-hmm. Not that far from where all this was going on, and what you said about, you know, guns being part of black culture. I'm from North Carolina. My mom moved to Detroit. I was only 2 years old. But when we came back, I was about 12 years old. And when we walked into my grandfather's house, the first thing I noticed was all these rifles and shotguns everywhere, sitting in corners and things of that nature.
Yeah,
so,
that's typical. Yeah.
Yeah, and that's the first thing I noticed, you know, about when we moved back down south, about Southern culture, all our family members. Now, about Robert F. Williams, I believe you may have misspoke. I was reading his book, Negroes with Guns, which I'm kind of confused about Dr. Martin Luther King being listed as a co-author of that book. I don't know much about
that. No, that's not true. Martin King was not co-author of Negroes with Guns.
Yes, his name is
That's
listed
Robert
on a top.
I don't know why it would be. That book was written by Robert Williams.
Yeah, it's, and that's why I said I don't know about it, and I'm asking because
I haven't seen that. Do you remember what publisher it was? Because I certainly will look it up.
It was a PDF file that somebody sent, and it had him listed.
Amazon. I'll look, but no, I can tell you with absolute certainty.
Okay.
Martin King had no involvement with Robert Williams' book. You know, the two were, in fact, at odds over self-defense and nonviolence and self-defense in many ways. Not as much as at odds as people think, but they were at odds in some respects. In their approaches to movement struggle with respect
I
to guns.
I found it, sir. I found it. This is why I asked that question, because it's listed on Amazon, Amazon.com, Negroes with Guns, the paperback.
Yeah.
It says by Robert F. Williams, author, Martin Luther King Jr., author, and somebody by the name of Truman Nelson, also giving author credit.
Truman Nelson had nothing to do with that either. Truman Nelson was a writer, a novelist, but no, I don't know how that happened. I have absolutely no idea how that would happen.
Well, I brought up the book just to, because I think you misspoke, but in the book he talks about at least three different instances where they use violence to repel. Okay, there was an attack on a doctor's house. I forget the doctor's name.
Yeah, those weren't police attacks.
Well, in the book it says that the Klan was being escorted by the police, and they shot up the police car. That's what it says in the book, sir.
Maybe one, but in general, I mean, I don't know of any instances where there were shootouts between Robert Williams's NACP or Robert Williams's chapter of the National Rifle Association and police authority. What I saw in tracking Williams, and I'm not perfect, so I can make mistakes, was them using weapons, particularly in Dr. Perry's case.
Yeah, Dr. Perry, that's his name.
Yeah, I know. Dr. Perry's case, that was a Klan attack. Even if they were escorted by the police, and the people who were largely being shot at and wounded were the Klansmen.
Yes.
And the same thing is true. Same thing is true for the Deacons for Defense and Justice, because I wondered about that question: how many shootouts took place between armed groups and policemen? And it's very difficult to find. It's not like prayer. You see that in the Reconstruction era, you will see shootouts between policemen and black union leagues and militias. But in the 60s, maybe. I mean, it's always possible. But to me, you see two categories of defensive, officially defensive violence. Individuals, farmers like C.O. Chin or Hartman Turnbow or E.W. Steptoe, fending off night riders. Or you see in some instances, particularly in North Carolina, Monroe, in Louisiana with the Deacons for Defense and Justice, and then there was an unnamed group in Tuscaloosa, Alabama, that protected Martin Luther King's organization in that city. But as far as I know, most of that has not been attacks on police. And you don't see much aggressive attacks at all, although Medgar Evers flirted with the idea for a second.
Yeah, I didn't say that they attacked the police. I said that they did shoot back at the police in that instance on the attack on Robert Perry, because it says in Negroes with Guns that he shot. I mean, it mentions shooting up the police car and then the people fleeing. And although he didn't shoot the one officer, where the title of the book came from was where they were about to be attacked by a white mob, and this cop comes up to him and tells them, you know, tries to tell him to turn over his guns, and I think he hits the cop and knocks him back with the butt of the other rifle.
Mr. Turnbow?
No, Robert F. Williams did.
I have to reread it because I certainly missed it when I read it. I'm not in a position to. I have to reread it. I don't see much attack one way or the other, defensive or aggressive, involving police.
Understood, sir. Understood, sir. So I just wanted to bring that up because I've been reading the book again just here recently, and I'm here in North Carolina. And, of course, you know that police were members of the Klan, so they may not have been in uniform, but they certainly were in their hood.
Oh, yeah, they were in the Klan, so, yeah.
All right, sir. Thank you again for this great work.
Thank you for your calls, guys.
Thank you for calling, yeah.
Caller, what's your name? Where you calling? 215 area code.
Philadelphia, Richard.
Yes, Richard. How are you, sir?
Hi. How you doing, man? Hey, Dr. Cobbs, I'm glad that y'all brought up this here discussion and conversation in the book, because I'm kind of thinking about this now, and I'm and from just a longer perspective as far. And I'll be short with this here as the question. Do you think that the black community, and I'm glad you focused in your work.
You're breaking up, Richard.
Do you think the black community in general is, as it organizes as community, is a not has a nonviolent belief?
As a nonviolent what?
Belief as the organizing principle of its community.
No,
of the community.
No, I don't think that.
And you know, okay, so because that's one of the ideals that I've been running around with. It seems that that's the nonviolent.
Nonviolence was a new idea. And where it worked, and it did work in some instances, where it really worked has to do with protests. If you're having a sit-in at a lunch counter or a restaurant or something like that, then nonviolence is a viable tactic. If you want to bring attention to the issue, win sympathy, and so forth. And that's what really drove all the, the Montgomery, Alabama bus boycott of 55-56. I think nonviolence demonstrated itself as being a viable tactic. Now, very few of the people using the tactic were, A, committed to nonviolence philosophically as a way of life, and secondly, when you get into the rural communities, the question of nonviolence simply doesn't exist, partly because there's no place to sit in. Where are you going to sit in, say, in a little bitty town where I worked in Sunflower County? It had 1,100 people at a gas station, maybe, the toilet. So it doesn't even exist in the conversation.
And if I may, and I just want to push this in a minute or whatever I have, is to push this for just a little bit. Because when you say that, I'm thinking of when and I like the phrase you use, defense and violence. So, like, these little towns and earlier even black settlements and, on the line, black settlements that were developed by black people, communities that were developed, it doesn't seem like with the terror of white groups over the history of black people that the communities were not that individuals had guns, not that some individuals will utilize their guns, but that the community was organized from a perspective of, if you came in to harm my community, we as a community, utilizing our guns in this environment, will protect it. Now, is it because they were overpowered over history, or is it because most people didn't believe that?
They were generally overpowered.
Okay, talk to me.
In Louisiana, I mean, we don't have enough time to go in Louisiana and the Colfax rioting, which is a long story. I tell some of it in the book. I mean, there are all kinds of examples. By the 1960s, I tell the story of a place that most people don't know about, never heard about, Columbia, Tennessee, without setting up the story to tell you why and all of this, the Klan was moving in, first the police, and this is an instance of when police got shot at, in 1946, and the police came in to followed by a mob to attack the black community. This is Columbia, Tennessee. And the word had gotten out. So blacks were all on the rooftops with their rifles. A lot of them were World War II veterans. And they fired back. They wounded four policemen. They drove the mob back. The result of that was then that the mayor of the town called the governor and asked that the National Guard be sent in. And the National Guard came in and essentially rioted, killing people, arresting hundreds of people, destroying black businesses and black property. So black people learned that you had to walk a careful line when it came to use of firepower, because the state, had far more armed resources than any black community, and the state would be called in on some instances. And so you see less organized groups of black defense and more individual defense. It's an interesting, I'm still thinking about this. I may write some more about this, sort of state response and black self-defense and whatnot. But the reason these groups that sought to protect the communities, in almost every instance, in the final analysis, they get overwhelmed by state power.
I appreciate your response, and thank you for helping me in this thinking about that. And I agree with you with your conclusion. Thank you.
Thank you for your call, Richard. Brother Ralph?
Yes, sir, Elliot. Hey, how you doing, Professor Cobb?
I'm doing fine. How are you?
All right. And I also had that book that Brother Scotty was talking about, Negroes with Gun, and it does list the other two guys there. But it's your experience, and that's why you're here, man. And I appreciate what you have done for us, Yeah, and I also have your book. Brother from South Carolina suggested that I get it because he realized that I was a person that always was bothered by the nonviolent movement. it seemed like we were just laying down, getting spit on, getting bit by dogs. And I remember as a young man in the 60s, my grandfather also having a bunch of rifles in that front room. And those rifles he had wasn't just for hunting. So I knew that as a young man that we were protected. And, you know, and later I found out from my father why he had his pistol also. But he said the Klan bleed like we do. And I lived down the rural parts of Eastern Shore, Maryland. So, you know, but we never had any trouble. It seemed like everybody stood their place. We did have the Klan down there, but they never came to our neighborhood. They never came in. You know, all the stuff that was shown to us on TV, we never experienced that down there. I never seen like absolute violence until I came up north. But down there, you know, and up north, I noticed that most of the black folk up north didn't have firearms. But down the South, everybody had...
Everybody had guns in the South. Yes.
Yeah. And also, as I was reading your book, I never heard of this lady, Cynthia Washington. But
She passed away last year.
Oh, wow. But, you know, I heard what she said, and that's why me, myself, I have a firearm, too. It's my right to have one to protect my home. And so I believe in self-defense, brother. I don't even call it violence. I call it self-defense. And what I read what she said in your book. She said, I decided it would be an unforgivable sin to willingly let someone kill my mother, only child, without a fight.
Right.
So I acquired an automatic handgun. But then when I read who she was the former field secretary of the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee. So,
right. Look, there was a lot of, you know, not everybody in SNCC, and probably not even most people in SNCC carried guns for lots of reasons. But there were guns nearby Austin. It was pretty much the attitude in the final analysis. It was an individual choice. You could choose to carry one or not carry one. We're not going to cross-examine you as to whether or not you're carrying a gun.
Right. And I also read in your book, and this actually did a lot for me, man. I mean, your book actually helped me because I could never understand, me myself, I could never understand the nonviolent movement. I couldn't, you know what I mean? And I always struggled with that part. Always struggled. And I'm just being honest about myself. Even though...
Well, a lot of people did.
Yeah, and even though I appreciate my ancestors and everything for everything they believed in, that song, We Shall Overcome, and all that stuff, it really depressed the hell out of me because I said, like, we still haven't overcome. I know.
But that attitude, we found that people in the North especially had that attitude.
Okay.
You know, they didn't understand the whole dynamic here. I mean, one, the nonviolent movement, sit-ins and all, that's happening in cities. Uh-huh. It's not happening in the rural community. So the choice is almost a personal, and if there's violence, say at a lunch counter sit-in or a restaurant sit-in, the violence is going to be directed at an individual.
Right.
In the rural areas, if there's violence, it's going to be directed at the community. It's collective punishment.
Right.
So the decision making is very different in rural communities than in urban communities. I mean, working for civil rights in Atlanta is not the same thing as working for civil rights in Sunflower County, Mississippi. Not that the two are disconnected, but the choice of what tactics to use are very different in those areas. See, if I'm surrounded by a mob, I can say, or if I know I'm going to be surrounded by a mob, I can say, well, no, I can't do that. I'm not going to participate in the sit-in. Or I can say I'm willing to take all that crap for the sake of the mission. It's my decision either way. That is simply not true in the world. In the town I worked in first, Woolville, Mississippi, when the Knight Riders came through and shot up the community, the two girls who were wounded were not involved with the movement. They just happened to stop by their grandparents' house to say goodbye before heading off to college and were standing in front of the window when the bullets came through.
And,
go ahead.
So that's a collective. See, you're faced with something different in the rural South than you are in Atlanta, Georgia, or Baltimore, Maryland, or other places where there was strong protest movements. So communities in the rural South tended to organize to protect the community.
Mm-hmm.
And that's also, what they... go ahead.
I know we have some callers on the line, but what I wanted to get to was when I read the part where in, I think it was 1956, and Bayard Rustin actually visited Martin Luther King, and he saw that Martin Luther King had firearms to protect his home. And not only Martin Luther King, but the community also was watching his home with firearms.
William Worthy, the journalist, was going to visit Martin King. This is 56. It was right after Martin Luther King's house had been bombed. And he came with Bayard, and as Bill Worthy was getting ready to sink into the armchair, Bayard noticed there were two pistols on the chair and warned him. He said, "You're getting ready to sit on a couple of pistols, Bill. Don't shoot yourself." And when they asked Martin Luther King about the pistols, his response was a Southern response. He said that just for self-defense. Mm-hmm. You know, that's how he saw it. He hadn't embraced nonviolence philosophically as a way of life at that point. If Bayard Rustin was still alive, he would now chime in and take a great deal of the credit for moving Martin Luther King to that embrace of nonviolence. Mm-hmm. Martin Luther King applied to carry for a concealed gun permit after his house was bombed. And he didn't get it, but it's easy to understand why. That's Southern culture you're looking at.
Okay.
And even transcends race because, in this white legislature, Slater, in Mississippi, this is, again, in the mid-50s, after the Supreme Court decision, tried to introduce gun control legislation. And he said, we need gun control legislation because too many blacks are getting guns. The bill never got out of committee.
Mm.
See, that's the culture of the South. Every man has a right to his peace.
Yeah, and like I said, my grandfather had, he had an arsenal in that front room, and they were all loaded.
Lots of people did. Lots of people did. Mrs. Fannie Lou Hamer, we were talking about her earlier. Mrs. Fannie Lou Hamer said at one point, she says, "I keep a shotgun in every corner of my bedroom. The first cracker tries to throw some dynamite on my porch won't write his mama again." That's Mrs. Hamer.
We're joined in conversation. Go ahead. No, I'm sorry. Go ahead.
No, I was going to say Mrs. Hamer's mother used to go out in the cotton fields carrying a pistol in a bucket.
We're joined in conversation this evening by journalist, visiting professor of African Studies at Brown University, and former field secretary with SNCC from 1962 to 1967.
Can I interrupt you? I meant to do this earlier.
Mm-hmm.
I meant to do this earlier, I should make a small correction here. I was a visiting professor at Brown University. I stopped doing that this year.
Okay.
And now I'm just writing, but I'm in the midst of a project. I do want to make a little announcement here.
Oh,
I've been working. We have a group called the SNCC Legacy Project that some of us formed on 650th anniversary. And we've been entered into a relationship with Duke University to produce a website around SNCC's work in the South. And that's going to be launching March the 2nd.
Okay.
And that's what I've been doing all of this year.
Okay.
Yeah.
And I noticed that you mentioned in our earlier conversation that a lot of your comrades, or several of the ones that you had mentioned had recently passed or passed within a couple of years. So
yeah, I mean, you think about it, we're all 70 and up.
Yes. Okay.
So, you know, we're getting up there, which is part of the reason we're anxious to
get this information
start
out.
Producing things, okay, you know, that reflect what we did in the South back in the day.
Speaking of what you did, Professor Cobb, I understand that you, either yourself or you were an integral part in starting the Freedom Schools in the Delta.
Yeah.
Talk about
well,
that.
It wasn't just the Delta. What had happened was, you know, we had decided to have this Mississippi Summer Project, these
okay
days called the Mississippi Freedom Summer. So, and we knew most of the students that we were talking about bringing into the state, upwards of 1,000 students, and we knew that most of them were going to be white. So the question of what to do with them obviously comes up. And it's within that context that I propose using them as teachers in freedom schools. Because, you know, in Mississippi, I mean, and it's still true today, I should say, that, you know, the schools were just awful. The state spent a fraction of the amount of money on black schools as they did on white schools. Libraries were practically empty. Laboratories, if they had them, were practically empty without test tubes and all of that. And, of course, you got no black history, no black culture, anything like that. So we thought we could take advantage of the students we had coming down to organize what I call freedom schools to begin to address this problem. Now, there's some forerunners to this. Septima Clark in South Carolina had begun developing citizenship schools in the 1950s. And when the students were arrested in Macomb, Mississippi, and high school students in 1961, the SNCC people organized freedom schools, or what they called nonviolent high school, in Macomb, Mississippi, that did much the same thing that the Freedom Schools of 64 did. And I was borrowing from those kinds of traditions, you know, because education and black liberation have always been linked. I mean, that's why, you know, during the era of slave rebellions, you know, plantation owners and the state blamed them on educated blacks.
Okay.
I mean, Nat Turner's in Virginia, after Nat Turner's rebellion, the governor said it was because black preachers were teaching reading and writing in Sunday school, and they banned black churches. So there's always this link between education and liberation when it comes to the black community, for certain. And Du Bois elaborates on this, certainly in Black Reconstruction, in his discussion of the kinds of schools that that came up. So, yeah, I proposed that idea for the 64 Summer Project.
And, you know,
in some respects, it continues.
Speaking of slavery, you mentioned in a video I saw of you that you were shocked, or maybe you weren't, that when they had cotton planting season, and it was time for harvest, that they closed down the schools.
Yeah, they closed down the schools. Not yet. They closed down the schools when it came time to plant the cotton in the spring, and they closed down the schools when it came down to what they call chop the cotton, which is just use a hoe to get the weeds away from the cotton, and they closed down the schools when it came time to pick the cotton.
Oh, well, closed down the black schools. I'm sorry. I'm done.
Yeah, black schools.
Okay.
Yes, the black schools, yes. So because the attitude of all the people in charge of education in Mississippi and Alabama and Georgia, all these places, was that what black people are supposed to do is provide a pool of manual labor for white people's needs.
Let's go to 2-6.
In some ways, that's the attitude about schools today. I mean, you look at the condition of a lot of these schools.
Exactly.
In inner cities.
267 area code. What's your name? Where are you calling from?
Yes, this is Brother Phil.
How are you, sir?
All right. How you doing, Elliot?
Great.
And Brother Reggie. And good evening to Professor Cobb. This is an interesting book. I never heard of it until the day I got an email from Brother Elliot, and that prompted me to call in. You mentioned SNCC and all that down there. Are you familiar with a Reverend Bevel?
And Jim Bevel?
Yes.
James Bevel? Yeah, I knew Jim very well.
Yeah, yeah. Now he was not, from what I'm gathering, he was the one who got, after most of the adults had gotten arrested on one of the marches, he mustered up the children and got
right,
them to
in Birmingham. In Birmingham.
Okay. Now what I'm trying to get at is what was the principle that he used to turn those children around so fast to get in line?
The kids wanted to be involved. Young people are always ahead of old people. And in Birmingham, the kids wanted to be involved. It didn't take much convincing to get the kids involved.
Okay.
You know, the problem in Birmingham was getting grown-ups involved. And they decided Bevel pushed for the idea of mobilizing the kids, middle school students, high school students, and in some instances, elementary students became involved, although that wasn't the main thrust. I swear he was interested in mobilizing middle school students and high school students. And he got thousands involved. And it was pretty easy to do.
Okay.
It was pretty easy to do. Everywhere in the South, it's the same story. I mean, if you enter in a little, even in Louisville, the little town I started working in, I mean, the first group of people to really come around were the high school students.
Mm-hmm.
Freedom riders are in town is how they saw it.
Yeah, yeah, because they were motivated to get involved because of what was going on down there. I think if it happened up here north, we would be doing the same thing. But I'm trying to get at I'm trying to get to this nonviolent approach. It's two sides to everything, as far as, you know, that's the way I learned things to be. And the nonviolent principles could work for us today amongst ourselves. That will wake up the consciousness so that we can get involved in what we need to get involved in. And I just want
really
to hear it. Yeah, yeah, because I happened to meet Mr. Bevel myself, and I was learning the principle, and that's the key to us today, that if we could get those principles in our heads, we would wake up overnight like the students did down there back in the 60s and stuff. Because he taught a very good classes while we, like when he came through Philadelphia.
And there's another issue around nonviolence that's very important to consider today.
Thank you for your call, Brother Phil.
You know, in these inner cities today, you know, where you see so much people of color shooting or trying to kill people of color, there's a discussion about nonviolence that needs to be had, I think, in these communities. I don't know how you would do it, but it seems to me that the discussion would be relevant in these communities where, you know the story, I mean, somebody's pissed off at somebody else, starts shooting at somebody else, and a stray bullet hits the little girl on the stoop or in the window or something like that. So there's a whole discussion that still needs to be had about nonviolence, I think. But how would it work in inner cities above the Mason and Dixon line? It's a complicated, difficult discussion, I think.
Let's go to 301 area code. What's your name? Where are you calling from?
My name is Watu. I'm calling from Maryland.
How are you, sir?
Pretty good. How are you doing?
Turn your radio down just a little bit. I hear a little bit background.
Okay. I want to say good evening to your staff, there, Brother Reg and Brother Ralph. Your guest speaker this evening, Mr. Cobbs. Mr. Cobb, I heard you speak, answer the question around the work in the rural areas. That's often, first of all, I want to say last week's program I listened to, and the brother Akinyele Omowale
Oja.
Yes.
And then your book, there was always a void, I thought, you know, in this phase of the civil rights struggle. Because I know that when African people were forced to come to this continent against their will, that we fought back. We fought back ferociously. And the brother Gerald Horn has written several books along those lines, showing our resistance to the earlier colonizers leading up to the 1776 war. But like I said, there was a void there, and I'm glad that this came out because I always kind of felt a little embarrassed, I guess that's the right word, about the civil rights movement because of this lack of any documented information around our efforts to fight back. So when I saw that, I was, you know, a matter of fact, I went out and got your book, and I haven't gotten We Will Fight, We Will Shoot Back book yet. Mm-hmm. So I commend you guys for that and, you know, your valiant efforts during that struggle. But my question is about the was it a strategy or was it a tactic to concentrate, to focus on those rural areas? And I'm saying that because I was part of an organization that most of the work, I come from a small town in Maryland, and there's a lot of small towns in this country, you know, with our people in it, but very not too frequently do we get the attention, the focus of people going in and organizing. A lot of the focus is on larger towns, and it was different during the civil rights movement when you guys went into to the Delta and you went into the, you know, the back towns. I was wondering if first of all, if that was a deliberate strategy. And
yes.
Do you see that effort being pliable today? Is it something that we could utilize?
Well, I think today, I think it would be much more difficult. I had to prioritize where to organize black struggle today. I would, although I think there are lessons from the work in the rural towns that can be used, I would have to prioritize the inner cities of, you know, urban inner cities, which would be where I would put the priority. Those are the new rural areas, if you will.
Okay.
Of the United States. It was a deliberate strategy in 1960 and 61 and 62 and 63, because that's where black people were.
Uh-huh.
You know, and that's where they could command, they had enough numbers to take on the political system. So it was quite deliberate, the decision to go into rural areas. I think today, and obviously, I mean, this is my personal opinion, it's the inner cities that we need to take on.
Uh-huh. Okay. I appreciate you answering that. Thank you.
Thank you for your call, okay. Brother Watu. Brother Rich?
Mm-hmm. Yes, sir.
Can you hear me? Yeah. Go ahead.
I know. I was sitting just enjoying Professor the history lesson.
Okay, Professor Cobb, two names before I transition over to when you moved out of organizing with SNCC. But, well, let me take this call first. 215 area code, what's your name? Where are you calling from?
How you doing, Brother Elliot?
How are you, sir?
I'm doing fine. Hey, Brother Ralph and Brother Reg. How y'all brothers doing tonight? And good evening, Professor Cobb.
Good evening. How are you?
Good.
I'm doing fine, my brother. Professor Cobb, first off, I want to say I'm going to definitely get your book soon. Before I make my comment, Professor Cobb, you know, we was talking about the gun control where that racist legislator was talking about having gun control because too many black people was getting guns. Well, you, uh-huh. as you know, Professor Cobb, you have a lot of these Republicans and stuff. They're against any kind of gun control legislation. It's the NRA, all these people, they fight against any kind of gun control to keep these guns, you know, out of the hands of people that got mental problems or people that's criminals. And you know, the effect that it has on our community, the black community. But you, as you say, Professor Cobb, if black people around this country starting droves, buying guns, getting legal guns, not illegal, but legal guns, joining gun clubs. Believe me, white folks would have no problem with gun control then. They would have no problem, they would have no problem with it, believe me. You know, but Professor Kyle, I just want to call and make this comment real quick. You know, when early in the show, Brother Ellie was talking to you about Mississippi and your feelings about going through Mississippi, you made me think about a comment Dick Gregory made to me one time. I went to see Brother Dick several years ago here in Philadelphia, and he was saying that, you know, the South was very scary for our people, whether it was Mississippi, Alabama, you know, Texas, South Carolina, the white races biggest down there. Our people was constantly in danger, and it was dangerous going anywhere in the South protesting, fighting for black people's rights. But Dick made a comment. He said that something, it was something about Mississippi, because he went down there with Dr. King a few times. He said, well, something about Mississippi that puts chills to him. He wasn't one to be scared easily. He says, but man, he says, it was something about that Mississippi going down there. He said, put chills in my bones. He said, even his wife, Lucille, who's a very spiritual person, she even said the same thing, too. She said, Dick, I got a bad feeling about this Mississippi. He said, that state just gives me chills, you know what I mean? So, yeah, so your point...
Mississippi was probably the most frontier-like place in the South, mm-hmm. whole state. You know, I mean, after Jackson, which had the state capital, which had about 140 or 50,000 people, the next biggest city had 50,000 people in it.
Mm-hmm.
And then it dropped down to 30, 10, 15,000. It's very rural, very violent. The culture was violent. I mean, guns were used to settle things,
mm-hmm.
not just against that's just the way they did it in the state. Whip out a pistol and shoot. So and you could disappear in this state, and it was scary. It was different than any other state. I mean, I've been in other states that have pockets. Like Mississippi, North Louisiana is just like Mississippi,
mm-hmm.
but New Orleans isn't.
Right.
Central Alabama, Lowndes County, Alabama, Greene County, Alabama, it's just like Mississippi. You put a circle around all these places, they're all the same place. Southwest Georgia.
Mm-hmm.
Mississippi, the entire state was this eerie. My friend Bob Moses, who was a state field secretary, said once, when you're in Mississippi, the rest of America doesn't seem real.
Yeah,
when you're in the rest of America, Mississippi doesn't seem real.
And Professor Kyle, you make a good point, because I'll close with these last couple of comments. When you look at the incidents that happened in Mississippi, not that the other atrocities that happened to our people throughout the South is not on the same level. You look at whether it be Emmett Till, whether it be what was the brother's name? They got killed down there. What's that? His name? I'm getting a blank. The brother got killed. The first secretary for the NAACP brother. Got killed in '63. I don't know why I can't think. I'm drawing.
You're
blank,
talking about Mega Evers.
Mega Evers.
Mega Evers. Okay. You look at the three civil rights workers that was killed.
Yeah, and when they were searching for the bodies of the three civil rights workers, they came up with four other bodies in the Mississippi River.
Mm. That's correct.
And nobody paid attention to them.
Mm-hmm. So you can see the atrocities throughout that state, and that's why I guess North Florida State gets killed through people. And I'll close with this last comment. A friend of mine's at my former job. She has family in Jackson, Mississippi. And to show you how some of the remnants of that fear is still in some of our people, and thank God that it's not in the majority of our people, whether it be in the North or the South, a friend of mine, she likes to work with, she said she went back to Jackson for a family reunion several years ago, and she said some of her aunts, who's up in their late 80s and early 90s, but had lived a long life, God bless them. She said some of them, even to this day, Professor Kyle, still got that fear of white people. She said she went in the store down there, and a little smart-ass white girl was very disrespectful. She was calling her aunt, who's old enough to be her great-grandmother, by her first name, which is common for a lot of white folks. So she said she corrected the white girl and said, look, get this woman respect. This is my aunt. You should be calling her ma'am or missus. So her aunt, who lived through all that horror, she said, watch your mouth, child. Watch your mouth, child. You can't talk to these white folks like this. And I'm going back to Professor Kyle. Yeah. This was back in, like, 1995.
Yeah, I know.
So, you know, that fear is still in some of our people down there. But thank God it's not the majority of our people, you know. But anyway, Professor, I want to monopolize. I want to, you know, thank you for your time and thank you for your good work. Keep, you know, keep doing what you're doing. And I appreciate all what you have done and all what you can continue to do in the future with God's blessings, because brothers like you, you need it. Like this L&M show is called Time for an Awakening. Lord knows our people need to be woke up.
Thank you for your call, Joe.
Thank you.
I thank you for your time. Thank you so much.
Okay, thank you.
Brother Red?
Professor Cobb.
Yes, sir.
Question that I have for you. I'm listening to all this great history that you're giving to us and also to the listening audience. And I'm seeing that you're still working and you haven't forgot the things that you've seen in the past. And you might have shifted from being out there in the mix on one level, but you're still doing something. What are your thoughts about the people who know, that were around you at that time, know about the struggle, but kind of changed their tune, almost like the things that happened in the past that you're relating to our listening audience, like it didn't happen?
Well, you know, it's funny. Obviously, I know the sick people better than any other group of people. A remarkable number of SNCC people continue to engage in struggles for social change. That's one thing. And I suppose my attitude is, well, they're humans. It's normal. You know, I've bounced over a lot of the world, especially in Africa. I've seen the same thing happen in South Africa, in Zimbabwe, Eritrea, and other places. So I'm not surprised. People get on, you know, they open the door of opportunity and then they walk through themselves and forget all the people who are still trying to walk through the door of opportunity. That's the contradictions of human beings.
And something that I know that you might be able to relate to everyone. I know now that money is usually the thing that gets a lot of people motivated to do things, whether it's community-wise or else. During the time that you were around, what part did money play as far as getting things done? And I'm talking about as far as organizing, and how was the money utilized? If there was money
connected? Money is important. I mean, we never had enough. You know, we were paid. You know, our salary was, as any SNCC person will tell you, our salary was $10 a week, which after taxes came out to $9.64. But that was money that had to be raised. You know, we needed cars. We needed all kinds of things in order to work. And we had a whole network of what were called Friends of SNCC offices in the North, in New York, in Chicago, in Philadelphia, in, you know, California, Los Angeles, and San Francisco, or the Bay Area, and so forth. And their job was to, A, raise money, and B, generate publicity about what was going on in the South. Money was a constant problem, but you needed it. There were things, we wouldn't do anything for money, but within the framework of our own beliefs, we did the best we could to raise the money we needed to do our work.
Brother Ralph?
Professor Cobb, now I'm looking at today's leadership. And, one guy, especially, he beats his chest and saying he's a day civil rights leader, but yet I see him taking photos with Donald Trump and smiling all at his face, and Sarah Palin smiling all at her after he's been trying to call these people the enemy and we should vote for the Democrats. You know, how strong was our leadership back there? Did they lean to a particular party? Do you think they would, like, be taking photos with Bull Connor and George Wallace? You know what
I mean? Look, it depends on what you mean by leadership. If you're talking about national leadership, that's not a discussion I'm very qualified have I find myself unimpressed with most national leadership then and now.
Right.
But if it's talking about local leadership, then what's remarkable about the South, and you can see it more clearly in the South, because you don't have, you know, you don't have the kind of political apparatuses, or at least then, you didn't have the kind of political apparatuses that you had in the North.
Right.
Like, so, you know, you had in New York, you know, the Democratic Party machine, or in Chicago, the Democratic Party machine, and they had their black leaders who managed those machines and claimed to speak for black people and all that. The South was just virgin territory in that sense. I found what I learned in the South was that you didn't have to have a college degree to provide intelligent leadership and committed leadership. I mean, this Mrs. Hamer story, she had a third grade education. You know, this is Hartman Turnbull's story, he had a sixth grade education. You know, you look at the leadership, the local leadership in the South, and it's all being ignored by media. See, media declares, just for reasons I still, and I've been a part of media for many years, media just sort of decides who's the black leader.
Right.
They say, okay, Martin Luther King III. What in the world qualifies him to be anything? You know, in the South, the leadership emerged from the grassroots, and nobody paid attention to it, to them except us.
Right.
But they were, that's my sense of leadership.
You know, and I'm gonna ask this, because I'm starting to see a shift. Like like you say, it's media driven. They're putting these people that's getting paid a tremendous amount of salary to be in front of us, and it seemed like our civil rights now, or human rights now, is basically voting for the Democratic Party. Let's get this next Democrat in office so we can
right.
beat the, and, you know, that's very dangerous, brother. If it's not coming from the grassroots and it's coming from them down, that's the reason why we've been stepped on for quite a long time.
When Stokely Carmichael and his group organized the Lowndes County Freedom Organization, or the Black Panther Party in Lowndes County, Alabama, they were fought by the black leadership establishment of Alabama that was scrambling for positions in the Democratic Party, which that were opening up for them because of the Voting Rights Act of 1965. Wow. There's always this problem of people who hustle on the backs of people who actually made the struggle, you know. And this is a worldwide. I've seen it all over the world, not just here in the United States.
It's a hustle,
Professor Cobb. Two people, before I transition to your years after SNCC, two other people I want you to give us your experiences with, Mega and Charles Evers, and also
very different.
Go ahead. That's what I was going to say, because they were brothers, but it seems as though they were very different. But talk about them.
They're very different. I mean, they start out sort of in the same place, two young boys, you know, and I tell a lot of their story in the book. Very strong father, and you often find a lot of these leaders we encountered also had strong family backgrounds. You know, their father, James Evers, was called Crazy Jim because he refused to step off the sidewalk when the white people were coming down the sidewalk. You know, was prepared to use his weapons to defend his family, and both boys were heavily influenced by their father, but they went in different directions after World War II. Megger stays on in Mississippi, becomes involves himself with an organization called the Regional Council of Negro Leadership, and then by the mid-50s becomes the state field secretary for the NAACP. And he's moving around the state, doing a lot of things around police brutality,
mm-hmm.
and a lot of things around gaining voting rights. And he mentored a lot of young Mississippians who would become SNCC field secretaries in the 1960s.
Okay.
There's a story in Joyce Ladner, for instance. These names probably won't mean much to your listeners, but I'll say a lot of the young people who would become a part of SNCC were mentored before SNCC by Megar Evers. Charles Evers went in the opposite direction. He left the state and really went to Chicago, becomes a businessman maybe, and was often on the shady side of the law, and comes back to Mississippi after his brother is assassinated and becomes a state field secretary for the NHB and begins working in the southwest corner of the state, a very violent place. And he sets up a machine that in some respects was bullying, I thought. You know, enforcing boycotts with guns, for instance.
Okay.
So there were a lot of tension. He didn't like SNCC, so we didn't have a lot of wasn't the same kind of relationship that we had with Megar.
He didn't like, you said he didn't like SNCC?
Yeah, Charles Evers.
Okay.
And whereas Megar, you know, I think in some senses, like Martin Luther King, both of those men, I think, saw sort of their young selves in the SNCC people.
Okay.
And so the relationship was more comfortable, easier.
You know, after these men, especially after Megar was assassinated and some of the other lynchings and deaths that might not even have reached the history books, what would be the tone of the meetings that you would have? Because I'm quite sure that you would have sessions after these things, and I guess people would quit and say, I'm done with this. What would be the tone? What would be said?
At what meetings now?
I mean, the SNCC meetings, your group that's organized.
Well, the meetings, there are two kinds of meetings.
Go ahead.
One kind of meeting are the people working full-time with SNCC, you know, which those meetings tend to be long.
Well, I'm talking about like the field secretary type of meetings that you were involved in.
Yeah. They tend to be long, lots of arguments inside the meetings. They tried to arrive at decisions via consensus as opposed to vote.
Okay.
Which guarantees lengthy meetings. But everybody was sharing the same danger.
Okay.
So in the final analysis, the fact that everybody needed everybody else to wash their back made for deep relationships. The SNCC people were close to one another for all of their differences. I mean, there's a lot of difference, say, between myself and John Lewis or myself and other people. But the organization, there's a kind of respect for each other inside the organization. The other kind of meetings that we had were with local people. So we tried to organize those meetings so people felt comfortable speaking up, speaking out, saying what was on their mind. We had to work at that.
Okay.
You know, and working in that involved everything from how the chairs were arranged. So rather than have anybody speak from a podium down to people, you sat in a circle. You knew people by name, and you would say, well, what do you think about that, Ms. Amer? And those are organizing meetings. You know, you wanted people to feel that they were taking control over the decisions that were going to affect their lives. That's what you were looking for. We had to learn how to do that, and we had varying degrees of success doing that.
Okay. I know that you mentioned earlier that a lot of the folks didn't like much traveling at night. Would you try to organize these meetings during the daytime so people wouldn't have to leave?
No, the meetings were almost always at night.
Okay.
Didn't like traveling. I mean, it depends on where you are. It's funny. Take the Delta. Delta's flat. You know, so you can be seen.
Okay.
There's a sense of feeling like you're exposed, right? It's flat cotton country. And I got comfortable traveling up there. But if you went down into southwest Mississippi, which is forested, I was very uncomfortable traveling at night because I always felt somebody could pop up behind a curve or a tree and do you in.
Okay.
But if you went down there, the people down there would say, I know you're glad to be down here because you're up there in the Delta You're up there in the Delta, Charlie, and everybody can see you for miles and miles away. And then if you went back up to the Delta, they'd say, I know you're glad to be back up here, Charlie, because you've been down there in southwest Mississippi, and people can come out from anywhere all of a sudden and do you in. So generally, night traveling was dangerous, but night traveling was unavoidable.
Okay.
I mean, people didn't have the spare time in the daytime to go to a meeting. You had, you know, you the church meetings were at night.
Okay. The last person before we transition is Stokely Carmichael, or later became Kwame Ture. I know you had close dealings with Stokely.
Stokely
talk
and I
about
were
it.
Classmates at Howard.
Okay.
Stokely and I were very close. Stokely had a special knack. People related to Stokely. He knew. He was skilled at relating to ordinary people. There was never the sense among ordinary people that he was talking down to them. You know, sometimes you had to rein Stokely in when if he got too full of himself. But there's no doubt about his intelligence, his commitment, and his courage, and that in the areas where I spent time with Stokely, travel with Stokely, people in those rural areas love Stokely. And they had a great impact on his thinking. You know, so his thinking, the question was, how do you empower these people? How do these people become empowered? That was always what was driving his thinking.
Okay. I want to leave Mississippi, because your work continued after your days with SNCC. But before I do, I'd be remiss if I didn't mention the movie Selma. Now, personally, I don't have much respect for stuff coming out of Hollywood, but what do you think about the movie Selma?
Well, it's, you know, I start with low expectations when it comes to a Hollywood film about the movement.
Okay.
And the Selma movie, it's useful. You can bring kids to it and they can find themselves engaged, if you will, by this Selma to Montgomery. The film itself is inaccurate insofar as real history is concerned.
Okay.
In almost every respect, from how the movement, how the march started, because it didn't start in Selma, it started in the next door county with a murder. They portray the murder in the movie as if it happened in Selma. It did not. It happened in Marion, Alabama.
Okay.
You know, a lot of the local people who, you would have the sense, SNCC went into Selma in 1963, so they've been voter, and then before SNCC went in, there's a whole history of political struggle in Selma and Dallas County, Alabama, that the movie ignores. A number of important people are briefly portrayed, not even fully portrayed, just briefly portrayed. So I have sort of this insider's criticism. It's a King-centric picture, of course. And King was far less important to Selma than people realize.
Okay. You know, I was looking at your work, and when you left SNCC and your activities with SNCC in Mississippi, you became involved with NPR, and it was something that I ran across that I was unaware of, the Bertrand Russell War Crimes Tribunal in 1967.
I was still with SNCC then.
Okay. And you were involved along with Stokely Carmichael and James Baldwin.
No, not really. The War Crimes Tribunal, my involvement with the War Crimes Tribunal is this. Bertrand Russell, the British philosopher, was interested to know what young people from an organization like SNCC would find they have in common with the Viet Cong.
Mm-hmm.
So he approached SNCC and asked if there was be people who'd be interested in traveling for a while with the Viet Cong and writing about their experience with the Viet Cong.
And I volunteered because I was interested in them, myself and Julius Lester, in fact. At the same time, he was planning this war crimes tribunal in Stockholm, Sweden. And Julius and I flew on over to Cambodia with the idea of connecting it with the Viet Cong and traveling with them. But there was a big American offensive taking place, so they said it was too dangerous, and we wound up going to North Vietnam instead and traveling. This was in 67, a couple of weeks, and Easter week, 67, I think, in North Vietnam. We had wound up spending a week or so in North Vietnam, and I didn't participate in the war crimes tribunal.
Okay.
That was taking place in Stockholm, Sweden, although Baldwin did and Belafonte did, as I recall. Okay. But we weren't connected in any way except that Bertrand Russell was sponsoring the War Crimes Tribunal, and he was sponsored the trip that Julius and I took in 1967 to North Vietnam.
Yeah, that you know, I was reading some of the things on that War Crimes Tribunal. It was very interesting how it was conducted. And what they covered and their conclusions.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, it'd be hard for me to recall now.
I understand.
I'd have to read up on it. It's so far back.
You know, when I read when you returned to the States that you and other SNCC veterans established a Drum and Spear bookstore in Washington,
yeah.
D.C., which was the largest black bookstore in the country at the time.
Yeah, we wound up establishing that because within the course of that trip, in fact, I spent some time in Paris and was spending a little bit of time at the Présence Africaine bookstore. And I liked that bookstore. And that bookstore was kind of a place where Africans, you know, met both Africans engaged in political struggles as well as writers and poets and musicians and the like. And I kind of liked that idea and said we should do something like that in the state. And Drum and Spear was set up to do that.
Mm-hmm.
And we were pretty successful at it. We had a lot of writers that came through and artists that came through. It was an essential stop, if you will, on the kind of our cultural trail in the black cultural trail, if you will, in the United States and in D.C. The problem was we weren't good business people.
Okay.
So the store lasted, let's see, I guess we opened that store in 68, and it lasted until 73 before our own bad business practices did it in.
Okay. All right. The Center for Black Education, also in Washington, D.C.
Mm-hmm. We were concerned about education. This is one of the forerunners of the Black Studies. But what had happened was, after the riots in Washington, D.C., the government, federal government, became frightened that you had all these black people in the United States and in Washington, D.C., one Vietnam War veterans and people coming out of high school with nowhere to go. So they set up what was an urban land grant college, Federal City College. And then they invited a lot of us who were in the movement to teach there. And we had been having a discussion about black education. Just as we were approaching, and decided to try and use Federal City College as a model or at least as a place to experiment with what we might do. Now, we had a different kind of definition of black education than is usually held for, say, black studies program. We said, after we were hired, well, look, we are not so much interested in black studies as we are in black education, by which we mean the question of education for black people centers on the question of
how an educated black person will use his or her skills for the black community.
Okay.
It's not just a question of studying black literature or studying black history. The question is, can you educate black people to commit to the black community? And that's what we want to see if we can do here. And Federal City College had no interest in that at all.
Okay.
And blocked us at every term as we tried to develop that. So we left Federal City College and formed the Center for Black Education, in which we would continue to experiment along those lines of education.
Okay.
And that, you know, there was a whole black education movement at one point in the United States. This is where the roots of black studies programs are, of course. I mean, you know, the Malcolm X University down in Durham, North Carolina. I forget all the schools now. But there was a whole movement around education. And this was in the late 60s, early 70s.
You know, you talk in a video I saw you in about your experience when you went back to Selma for the anniversary of the Selma March. And you were in Mississippi, and you passed by the Fannie Lou Hamer Library and saw some children outside. Talk about that, because I think
The Brinkley Middle School, which is in Megger Evers' old neighborhood in Jackson, is directly across the street from a public library, the Fannie Lou Hamer Public Library. And I had to go, I wanted to give the principal of the middle school a copy of a book I had written that involved her school.
Okay.
It was a book I had done with Bob Moses. And I was sitting on the steps with these, surrounded by these middle school kids after I left the principal's office. I don't know, six or seven of them. I was waiting for a ride. I was getting ready to go up to the Delft. So I looked across the street and saw that the Fannie Lou Hamer Library was there and decided to engage these kids in conversation about Mrs. Hamer and just sort of asked, does anybody know anything about Mrs. Hamer? And if so, can you talk to the others here about who Mrs. Hamer was? Sort of what I only half jokingly sometimes say when it's an old guy speak. And they didn't know anything about Mrs. Hamer, not a one of them. So my ride came, and I had to go. So I stood up, and I pointed at the school, and I said, well, you all need to know something about Mrs. Hamer. She was really important to this state. And I knew her, I told them. And I was getting ready to tell them a Mrs. Hamer's story before I got in the car. But when I said I knew her, one of these kids, he must have been about 13, I guess, jumped to his feet. He stared at me in total amazement and said, I never will forget the words, Mr. Cobb, you was alive back then? And, you know, and I got it, you know. I'm talking about somebody whose name is chiseled by the library, you know. And I'm still alive. I mean, dead people's names. And the friends of people whose names are chiseled on the library must be dead. So how can I be saying I knew this lady? And it dawned on me then that we have a real problem or issue here with educating young people to the movement. And in a lot of ways, it was a turning point for me because, up until that point, I had largely been, as a reporter, a foreign affairs reporter. I covered Africa. I worked for National Geographic magazine for many years. I bounced all over the world covering foreign places. And I said, well, I need to turn my attention to how you write about this movement in the South more than writing in foreign affairs. And that's all I've ever done since then. I'm writing just about the South now.
Okay. Professor Cobb, you're involved now with the as a senior analyst for AllAfrica.com. Tell our listening audience about that.
AllAfrica.com is now an online news service, and I want to emphasize it's a news service. You go to www.allafrica.com if you want to know what's happening in Africa day to day. It's news. It's not soft. It's not features. It started out as Africa News Service, which was a print, 8-page print vehicle. This is in 1972 or 73. And then as the internet developed, has gone completely now on online. It has contracts with now 130 African newspapers, and every story that those papers publish are republished by allafrica.com.
Okay.
They're reorganized depending on what the news is, but somewhere everything from sports and cultural stories to hard news stories, everything those papers publish, we republish. And we resell stories from those papers to a range of other media organizations and split the sales with whatever African newspaper is using whatever story. It is the organization, which was based in Washington, D.C. in the United States, has largely left the United States now. It has offices in Cape Town, South Africa, Abuja, Nigeria, Monrovia, Liberia, and Lagos, Nigeria, and Dakar, Senegal. The site publishes in French and English. It also generates original stories. I don't live in Washington, D.C. anymore, but when I did live in Washington, D.C., I would also function as kind of the diplomatic correspondent. In other words, when African leaders came to the United States, I would interview them. I would interview U.S. policymakers on Africa about a range of issues affecting Africa. It's very successful. It's the biggest online service in the world presenting news on Africa. And is read in lots of quarters in Africa. And, of course, by people in the United States that are interested in Africa. But I'm not sure what those numbers are.
Before you leave us this evening, Professor Cobb, talk about your grandfather. Your great-grandfather. He started a farming community in Mississippi in 1888 called New Africa. Do you know much about him?
I know a little about him from, it's funny how things work. I had one of my sisters taught school in Africa, in East Africa, Tanzania, and she and her husband, and both of their children were born in East Africa. So when the first child was born in East Africa, my great aunt, Hattie, decided the family had come full circle and began to dictate the family history into a cassette tape and send the cassette to my mother or my mother's sister. And a lot of it is discussion of a community called New Africa, which my great-grandfather, who had been enslaved in Alabama out from Wetumpka, had helped found after the Civil War. He migrated after the Civil War from Alabama to Mississippi, acquiring a little bit of an education on the way at what was then Fisk Normal School, now Fisk University.
Okay.
And taught school in Natchez, Mississippi. And then, as he put it in one of his papers, with the right kind of Negro, migrated up into the Delta, which then, this is before the levees and before the railroads and all of this, so it's pretty much swamp. It's bears and alligators and yellow fever and all of that. This was in 1888. And with a whole group of people founded a farming community, New Africa, which is still there, by the way, although people don't have much historical memory about the roots of the community. He himself died young, and the community, I think, came under assault from planter power once the levees were built and holding back the Mississippi River. The land becomes, and the lumber, you know, the Delta really was driving what was initially driving the economy of the Delta was not cotton, but timber.
Okay.
But once the levee is held back, you know, and the railroads now start to be built running, you know, north, the land becomes much, much more valuable. And these black farmers who are scattered throughout the Delta come under assault. The only remaining black community now in the Delta
is about Bayou, Mississippi.
Okay.
But my great-grandfather was part of that movement, which is easy to understand. If you've been enslaved by some white people, you want to, one, get away, get as far away from them as you can, and B, you want to own some land.
Okay.
So we grew up kind of, we never knew the name of the community until my great-aunt started to come to strip, but we did grow up with stories, you know, about life in Mississippi in the late 19th and early 20th century as kids, my sisters and I.
Professor Cobb, I want to thank you for your contribution to our history. You led an interesting life. And to bring this era into print about the men, sometimes nameless and faceless men and women, that helped protect the civil rights the movement in Mississippi and in other places, I'm glad that you brought these people to life. You gave our people an insight on them, our listening audience tonight, and I recommend that our folks get the book. This nonviolent stuff will get you killed. Before you leave us this evening, Professor Cobb, tell us where we can get the book, any information you want to give out, websites, contacts, anything you want to tell us.
Okay, the book the book is available on Amazon or Barnes & Noble. You know, either you can walk into Barnes & Noble or order from Barnes & Noble online. You can get it from Amazon.com. This nonviolent stuff will get you killed. It's probably the easiest and cheapest way to get the book.
Okay.
The book came out in June, so it's fairly new as a book. I think, I hope people who are listening and interested in Africa check out allafrica.com if they have not. And you need the Google search. We have like I said, I can't think of what the site will be, but we will have a one-person, one-vote website that we launch March the 2nd. And that'll be the name, I think, www.oneversononevote.org or something like that.
Okay.
That'll be worth looking at because it'll have a lot of personal profiles of people, events, and whatnot. Or look up the website. You can find a link to it when it launches at the SNCC Legacy Project website, too, and you'll have to search for the exact URL.
Okay. I want to thank you for being with us this evening. Thank you for your contribution to history.
And thank you for inviting me and spending this time with me.
Thank you, sir. And we'll talk to you again soon.
Okay.
We'll be right back.
Bye. Bye.